audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Moshe New, Rabbi at the Montreal Torah Center in Montreal, Canada.
This week's parsha is Beshalach, which describes the Exodus and its aftermath. It's also called Shabbos Shira, the Shabbos of Song, because in this week's Torah portion, we read about the song that the Jewish people sang after they crossed the Red Sea and after the Egyptians, who had followed them in hot pursuit, met their just reward. We're going to examine the first verse of this song and the final statement on this song, which describes the song of the women led by Miriam. So, we read chapter 15, verse 1, reads as follows. Then there sang Moses and the children of Israel this song to God, and they said, saying, and then it goes on to describe the song. Close the book, please, so you're not distracted. Again, then, actually it says he sang, but anyway, that's another difficulty. Actually, the verse literally reads, he will sing in the future. This is an aside, this is not tonight's subject, but as an aside, this is one of the allusions in Scripture to the resurrection of the dead, isn't it? Because it uses the future tense. It's describing a past event, and it says it in the future, then the Jewish people and Moses will sing. They haven't since then. Torah is saying that there will come a time when they will, which means that they're coming back. This is one of the biblical sources for the 13th principle of Jewish faith, and that is that all bodies are ultimately resurrected and return, and the souls return to earth. That was an aside. Now back to the subject at hand. Now the strange thing is that Moses is part of the Jewish people, isn't he? Right? So why does the verse say, then Moses and the Jewish people sang this song and they said, saying, rather than, then the Jewish people sang? So there are two difficulties with this verse. Why is Moses separated from the people? And the end of the verse is also difficult because there seems to be an absolute redundancy. It says, and they said, saying? What's this, the meaning of the word saying? And they said. So the verse should have read, then the Jewish people sang, and they said, and then quote the words of the song. Doesn't say that. It says, and then Moshe, Moses, and the Jewish people sang this song to God. And they said, saying. So we have a problem with the word saying that just doesn't add anything at all. And why is Moshe separated from the peoples? So the Talmud notices this problem. And the Gemara of the Talmud in Tractate Sota brings the following. There are three views there. There's the view of Rabbi Akiva. There's the view of Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi Haglili. Let's call him Rabbi Eliezer. And there is the view of Rabbi Nehemiah. And they address both questions, really. Why is Moses mentioned on his own? Because he had a different role, or a distinct role here. What exactly that is, that's their difference of opinion. As for the meaning of the word Lamar saying, the Torah is also telling us that there was something unique about how and what the Jewish people said, or how they said it, and that is alluded to in this extra word, saying. Now here are the three views. Rabbi Akiva says it worked like this. He says it's just like in the old days when people didn't know how to daven, and when it came to the recitation, for example, of Hallel, songs of praise and thanksgiving on holidays and days of celebration. So the reader would read and discharge everybody their obligation by everybody listening to him. And they would simply respond, Hallelujah, praise the Lord. That's how the Hallel was said at a time when people did not know how to daven themselves. In similar fashion, Rabbi Akiva said, that's what happened here by the shores of the Red Sea. Moses said every verse. All the people did was respond, Ashira Lashem, I will sing to God, which is the very next words in the sentence, right? And the people sang this song to God, and they said, saying, I will sing to God. Rabbi Akiva says, that's all they said. So each line, each sentence, each stanza of this song was said singularly only by Moshe, by Moses himself, and the people were listening, and he was saying it, as it were, for them, like the one who would recite the Hallel for the congregation, and their participation was simply saying, I will sing to God at the end of each refrain. That's the view of Rabbi Akiva. Second view. Rabbi who? Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi HaGlili. All right. He says it's like the case where a child would lead the congregation. When a child leads the congregation, he cannot discharge them of their obligation by having them listening to him, since he is not obligated in the first place. How would a child lead the congregation? He would say the words and they would repeat them after him. That's what happened here. Moshe said each refrain, each line, and the people repeated it after him. But they said everything. They said it all. But they said it after him. That's the meaning of why Moshe is separate. That's what the word saying means. According to everybody, it's kind of a response. But what was the response? Rabbi Akiva says the response was minimal, nominal. Just, I will sing to God. I will sing to God. With every line that he said. And Rabbi Eliezer says that they responded and they said every sentence. And the third view, Rabbi Nechemiah said it was like the teacher who teaches his children in the synagogue. He's teaching them Torah. And it comes the time for prayer. And he simply starts them off. And then everybody says it together after that. There are different explanations into exactly what Rabbi Nechemiah is saying. But this is the gist and summary of it. The teacher begins. And they all chime in then, all the students. And they say it all together with the teacher. So too says Rabbi Nechemiah. Moshe Rabbeinu only began the first words. And then everybody chimed in, and lo and behold, without being prompted, everybody prophetically, so divinely inspired by the awesome event at what they had seen, all composed spontaneously and simultaneously the very same words. It was a time of incredible a collective prophecy or divine inspiration. Let me just add here at this point that Hasidus, the Kabbalah, the Zohar explains that the crossing of the Red Sea, the splitting of the Red Sea was much more than just that. The splitting of the Red Sea. The sea in general represents the hidden reality. The sea hosts a far more complex world than life on terra firma, except we don't see it. Looking at the sea, we see just this vast expanse of water. It's lost on us. But there are mountains and valleys, and it's teeming with complex and multifarious life. The sea is symbolic of a hidden world, a hidden reality. The same is true of the world of spirituality. It's there all around us, and it teems too with life and creatures of all kinds. But we don't see that under normal circumstances. We don't see heaven. Heaven isn't out there. Heaven is here. It's just lost on us. We're totally insensitive. But then, at this moment, when the sea split, the heavens split. The hidden world opened for them. And they were able to see and pierce the very heavens themselves. In fact, our sages say what a maidservant saw when at the crossing of the Red Sea, the greatest prophets later never didn't see. We're not privy to. Isaiah, Ezekiel, who had visions of the divine chariot and so on. They didn't see what a child saw on the shores of the Red Sea. So therefore you won't be surprised at Rabbi Nechemiah's explanation that they all said this song in prophetic unity, because it was a time of awesome revelation. The question is, though, according to the third view, Rabbi Nehemiah, why did you need Moshe to start them off anyway? Since everybody was so divinely inspired, and since everybody was saying the same words at the same time, then it just all could have began spontaneously at the same time, or at the swing of his baton or staff. Why did it have to begin with him? And then they all chime in. And scripture clearly is saying that, right? It says, then Moshe, Moses, and the people sang. According to the first views, it's clear why Moshe has to do it first, because either he's the only one singing the song, and they're just saying, I sing, I'm with you. Or, and then for sure, Moshe's role is clearly necessary. And even according to the second view, who's that? Rabbi Eliezer. He's got to do his thing because they were repeating. They're just repeating. But according to Rabbi Nehemiah, why does Moshe identified separately? Why does he begin the whole process? And furthermore, why are they arguing anyway? What's the difference? What's the difference how it happened? What's the lesson? What's the message? We'll see in the end that the truth of the matter is, I might ask therefore another question. The question is, how can you argue about a fact? What I'm asking is, everything in Torah is true. Everything is true. Rabbi Kiv is true. Rabbi Eliezer is true. Rabbi Nehemiah is true. So which way was it? Well, that question is easily resolved. What would you say to that? Which way was it? Always. Some people did it like this, and some people did it like that, and some did it like that. But the question still remains true. Obviously, all three happened, but what's the significance of these three ways of singing? And what's the lesson? Yeah, there are different levels. What are these levels? In order to explain this, we first have to understand that the fact that everybody was singing the same song, regardless now of how they did that, the fact that the same words were said on behalf of or by every person meant that then they had achieved the level of absolute unity. These words were equally expressive of the truth that was in all of them, which means that a fundamental equality and unity was achieved. Moreover, at this time, the Jewish people achieved a level on par with Moses himself. Listen to the following commentary of the Medrash on these words, then Moshe and the Jewish people sang. This is what the Medrash says. Moshe, he's like all the Jewish people. All the Jewish people, they are just like him. This sentiment actually is expressed by Rashi in his commentary on the Chumash elsewhere. And I point this out because, as we all know, Rashi wrote a commentary for a five-year-old. It's the most basic, elementary commentary on the Chumash, and as we previously were learning, it's also the most basic commentary on the Talmud. And Rashi, in his commentary on the Bible, on the Chumash, in the book of Numbers, writes there, he says that, Hanosi hu hakoil, the leader of the generation is like everybody, equivalent to everyone. What does this mean? First question. And second question, the Midrashic commentary we just looked at seems to be a little redundant. It starts off saying and explaining why is Moshe mentioned separately, to teach you that Moshe is equivalent to all the Jewish people. And then it goes on to say, and all the Jewish people are equivalent to Moshe. Well, isn't that saying the same thing twice? The answer is to both the questions we just asked, namely, why is Moshe equal, first of all? And secondly, why describe the equality both ways? The answer is, Moshe is equal because the soul of Moshe, and this is true of the tzaddik of every generation, is what's called a collective soul, to which all other souls are connected. And in fact, all other souls derive from. The class we're having tonight is also in connection with the 10th day of Shvat. Because on this day, on Friday, around the world, we celebrate, we mark, we observe the day when the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, passed away, the 10th of Shvat, Tavshin Yud, January 1951, and the day when the Rebbe assumed the leadership of Chabad Lubavitch. And so, we are talking here about the role of the leader and his relationship with the people. So it ties into this parsha. So what did we just say now? We said that Moshe Rabbeinu, the tzaddik of the generation, is akin to the head and the heart of the people. Let me elaborate upon this a little bit. A valid question might be posed, and that is this. How is it permissible for a Jew to go to a tzaddik for a blessing when there are no intermediaries for the Jewish people and everybody has a direct access to God? And yet this is fundamental in all walks of Jewish life, Hasidic or otherwise, to go to the sage for a blessing and so on. And we might elaborate upon the question and bring the question into sharper focus by pointing out the following. The law is that if an angel were to appear to you, if that were to happen, and you were to ask the angel to help you, that is idolatry, or subtle idolatry. What do you mean the angel should help you? There is only one God, and to address the angel is to give something other than God any validity and independence. And although you might believe that God is the ultimate controller, but he's more than that. He is the only reality. And for the Jew, that will be forbidden then to request the angel to help you. Moreover, the law is, even if you were to ask the angel to bring your case before God, is also forbidden. What, God can't hear you? He's up there in the seventh heaven, that you have to send emissaries and messengers? God is omnipresent, he's everywhere, and hears everyone. So having said that, our question now is much stronger. How then, Torah not just allows, but it's a great merit and schus to be able to go to the tzaddik and ask for a blessing. Tzaddik gives a blessing. So the answer is that you're allowed to, one can, allowed, it's more than allowed, we'll see, to go to any Jew for a blessing, because since all the Jewish souls are one, we are one great body, you haven't gone outside of yourself when you address another Jew, it's part of who you are. So it's like the finger is cut, and the mouth, the head, speaks to the doctor. There's no dichotomy here. There is no, conflict. It's one body. To take this analogy a little further and a little deeper, that tzaddik is the head of the generation. In fact, the word Rebbe stands for three words, Rosh B'nei Yisrael, the head of the Jewish people. So the point is that just like the head feels every pain and sensation in the body by virtue of the nervous system, you see, when you go to the tzaddik, you're not going to somebody else. It's your pain, your blessing is his. Your simcha he feels, and your pain he feels, because this is what's known as the soul. The truth is all souls are interrelated, but in a much more direct and clear way, the tzaddik of the generation, the head, the brain of the generation, like the brain of the body, feels every sensation that happens to every limb and organ of the body. Going to the tzaddik is not going to an intermediary between you and God. It's, in fact, when the tzaddik prays to God, he's praying for a pain or a need that he himself feels, because you and he are one. It's even deeper than that. It's not only, this is really no word to describe the following statement. You'll decide yourself how to describe this. But here it is. It's not only that the tzaddik feels what's happening with every part of the body, like the brain and head feels the sensation that occurs to every part of the body. It's deeper than that. In the same way that the brain not just feels what's happening in the finger, but the reason that the finger has the sensitivity for pain in the first place, that itself is the brain's input. This too, that a Jew feels and senses God's presence and would turn to him for help or for praise when things go well, that spiritual sensitivity in the first place is the tzaddik's input. This is what the Zohar means when it calls Moses the shepherd of faith. He's called the Raya Mehemne in Aramaic. It has two translations. The simple translation is faithful shepherd. Moses is a devoted leader. But it means deeper than that. He is a shepherd of faith. He nourishes and sustains his people with divine sensitivity. The Alter Rebbe in Tanya, in chapter 2 of Tanya, quoting from the Talmud, says, actually, this is a Talmudic concept. It's just explained and elaborated upon in Hasidic teachings. The Talmud says, Torah says, Scripture says, you shall cleave to God. How do you cleave to God? Says the Talmud. Cleave to the sages, and that's how you cleave to God. Are we speaking of intermediary? God forbid. Cleaving to the sages means being in touch with your own source. A healthy body is a body where the lines of communication between the brain are free-flowing and uninterrupted to every part of the body. And the sensitivity and the growth that each organ and limb of the body should experience is dependent upon the open lines that it has with its own source, its own mind and brain. This is the mystery. This is the mystery that explains the unique relationship between a Jew and his Moses, or a Chassid and a Rebbe. There's nothing in the world closer than that. Because the tzaddik of the generation is not somebody or something else. The truth is, no Jew is something or somebody else. All souls are in essence one. Where is that level where their oneness is manifest and revealed? That's the tzaddik of the generation. To explain this a little clearer, the truth of the matter is, when God first conceived of the Jewish people, He conceived of one soul. We really are at the root one Jew. There's one quintessential Jew. This soul just breaks down and breaks down and breaks down and breaks down into the myriads of details that are each one of us and the myriads of Jews that have lived. But they are all just fragments of an indivisible godly entity, the godly soul, and that's the tzaddik of the generation. Ultimately, Mashiach is the ultimate statement on this Jewish soul source. What Mashiach is, he's the Moses of all generations. So we digressed. We didn't digress, but we've given a lot of background. Let's go back to the statement. We've answered only one of the two questions we just asked. First we asked, why is Moses compared to all the Jewish people? And the answer is because, in fact, that is the downlink. That is the collective soul of which all individual souls are a manifestation, are an expression of, extend from, are connected to. The second question we asked was, remember, the apparent redundancy in the Medrash? The Medrash says, Moses, he's like all the Jewish people. All the Jewish people, they're like Moses. Now, he said it the first time around, it's the same thing the other way around. What does the Medrash mean? But the Medrash means, Moses is like the Jewish people. Well, that's true all the time from his perspective. He sees every Jew, it's all one. It's all one. In the most absolute way. This is the only way, by the way, to explain the self-sacrifice and devotion that a Rebbe has for his people. It cannot be explained in any loving, emotional, rational terms at any level. The only explanation is that every year there's him. Every Jew, every child is infinitely precious, not because he's infinitely precious. The affinity, the closeness is so. I speak about the affinity. The affinity that a Jew has with a Rebbe is it can't be explained. Such a closeness, such an intimacy, because it's really, in essence, it's one soul. So that from Moses' perspective, that's always happening. Every Jew is beating in his breast, is in his uppermost thoughts all the time. But what happened here at the crossing of the Red Sea was the other way too. Not only is Moses equal to all the people, now at this song, because the Medrash is commenting on this song, the people were all like Moses. This was a moment where everybody felt it. Everybody felt this fundamental unity. We were all saying the same words then. We were all there. We were all there. That just like we were there at Sinai, we were there also on a spiritual level at the crossing of the Red Sea and at the Exodus on a subtle level. When we sang that song at the crossing of the Red Sea, it wasn't like, you know, trying to catch the words from somebody's lips and say the words along with them. It just came out from everybody, this fundamental oneness. And it's all ignited by Moshe. We've answered one question. Why does Rabbi Nehemiah, who anyway says everybody said the same thing, why does Moshe have to start the whole thing? Because that's where it all begins. Why are they all saying the same words? Because they experienced their fundamental affinity with Moses then. That's what was in a state of revelation and sparked them. The connection to him was so deep and so true that, and everybody felt that therefore everybody praised and sang to God in exactly the same immortal words that we sing and say every day since then in our morning prayers. And on special occasions, more than once. This song is part of it's immortalized in our daily siddur. So now we have to explain the three views. What are these three opinions? Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Nehemiah. They are describing three levels of relationship, three levels of unity between the soul and Moses. But first, by way of analogy. It's more than analogy, actually it's a different expression of the same concept, the same truth. Chassidus explains there are three kinds of self-sacrifice. There are three levels where a person can be completely surrendered and united with God. One level is, what God says goes, and that's it. And my mind, my heart, my feelings are completely overridden, right? Completely nullified, completely ignored, and it's pure, absolute faith and surrender. The mind's questions or the heart's feelings are dismissed. The person operates on the level of pure faith alone. Pure, unadulterated, absolute devotion and surrender to God that is unquestioning, that doesn't take into account even mood or feeling or any other human consideration, any other consideration of my persona, irrelevant. God said, that's it, beginning of end of story. That's one level of faith. That's one level of surrender, one level of relationship. A second level is, I'm not ignoring my mind, but I'm forcing my mind to follow the dictates of my faith. I make myself intellectually acknowledge and submit to the truth of faith. I'm not ignoring the mind. I am bringing the mind and questions in the heart into the picture rather than ignoring them, but at the same time they are made to pledge their allegiance and loyalty to the dictates of faith. And then there's a third level, and the third level is where the mind, through its own conclusion, and the heart, through its own sense of feeling, concludes and accords with God's demands, with the simple surrender of faith. Do you hear the difference? In the first case, the mind is out of the picture. In the second case, it is harnessed. And the third case, the mind itself willingly from within concludes and understands the truth of God's will and commandments and willingly, voluntarily from within surrenders. The first case, we're ignoring the mind. In the second level, we're overwhelming it or harnessing it. And on the third level, the very mind itself, from within, is in agreeance that this is truth. It's the mind's truth. The mind rationally has concluded the truth of faith. That's not surrender. No. And this is the difference between Rabbi Akiva's scenario, Rabbi Eliezer, and Rabbi Nehemiah. Rabbi Akiva said, you know what happened then? Moshe did all the talking. Everybody just went, uh-huh. I agree. The self there is completely ignored. He says, in other words, that they reached a level there of the soul that transcends rationale, transcends feeling. It was the raw, pure, godly essence which is one with Moses, at which level all Jews are one. Moshe speaks, everybody just nods their head. That's it. You don't even say anything. No words come from your mouth. Rabbi Yosef Lili says, no. That soul connection was filtered down and employed also the human faculties. They also spoke. They also said. Now what are they saying? They're saying what? Repeating what Moshe did. So we're bringing the human aspect into the picture. We're bringing the mind and the heart. But the mind and the heart is overwhelmed by or harnessed by the transcendent godly truth. And so it repeats after what soul essence, soul core, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses says. But in this case, scenario two, they're saying words. They're saying them. But they're saying them after Moses. So bring your feelings in. Bring your heart in. Bring your mind in. We'll discuss, we'll talk. But we're going to discuss and talk, and we're going to feel exactly that which the soul essence feels. And the third level, Rabbi Nechemiah says, they didn't even repeat after him. That truth was something that they themselves had felt within themselves. The human part of them had come to this conclusion. This, in fact, is the ultimate unity, where it's their own personal statement is in accord with their soul essence, who is Moses. To make this a little clearer, let's try and explain this in terms of three environments we might find ourselves and our response. There are times when a person will just simply, look, surrender to God's will. Despite the fact, I don't understand the reason for this, I'm not inspired, I don't feel this, but for whatever reason, God said so, I'll do it. That's the Rabbi Akiva thing. You're just completely bypassing your whole self, and you're tuning into your faith, and you do. Then there is a scene when, perhaps, you might come to shul on an occasion, and it's an inspiring, and you become swept along with the inspiration and the concepts that are being said. They're not your concepts. You haven't integrated them yet. It's not your opinion. Someone else is doing the talking. The environment was such that you didn't create, you've come into it. But it's such an overwhelming environment that it pulls your emotions and your mind along too. It makes sense. And you feel it. But the reason it makes sense and you feel it is because it's such a powerful experience that it has kind of swept you along. So in this scenario, you're not ignoring your feelings or your mind. Your mind and your heart is there. It's enlightening, this experience, and this is emotionally fulfilling, but it's not really yours. It's external to you. You're being swept along. That's Rabbi Eliezer. He's saying they brought down this level of unity down to the human level, but only to the point that it kind of just propelled them and swept them along. And imagine a third scene, a third scenario, where you're not in a place of inspiration. You're not in shul, and you're not, you know, the whole atmosphere and the song, whatever it is that moves us sometimes. And you create that kind of inspiration yourself. You start singing the song. First scene is, you hear the song and you say, oh, beautiful song, wow. Second case is, it touches you, you start singing along with it. But the third case is, you compose the song. That's how in touch you are with your own soul essence. That's Rabbi Nechemiah. That's the third level. That is the greatest degree of unity. Each one has its advantage. And time doesn't permit us now to explain why Rabbi Akiva said what he did, because that reflected his own personal level. Rabbi Akiva came from converts. Rabbi Akiva came from a place of darkness, and his whole movement in life was transcendence. Never mind all this. Just pure, absolute pure faith. His movement was away from the machinations of the human condition. Just to explain Rabbi Akiva, but it's also reflected in the other sages as well. Rabbi Nechemiah, Nechemiah means comfort. It's a reference to Mashiach, to the Messianic era, which is a time of comfort too. He expresses the ultimate unity. That the unity between God and the Jewish people is so real and so true that it's your truth. That song springs from your own lips, because that's how deeply and truly you're in touch with your own soul essence, symbolized by Moses. It's now what you are. You're not saying what somebody else says or nodding in agreement. It's your own song. And these are the three degrees of unity that are described here by the three sages. And as people suggested earlier, what happened? All three, depending on which level. And in fact, we can take it even further and understand that it happened on all three levels for everybody. Everyone. Initially, it starts with blown away, pure faith. You see Moshe Rabbeinu and that's it. You melt. You're gone. You face your own truth. That's an overwhelming experience. You overwhelmed all of your whole system. Overload the system. He says you nod your head and that's the end of it. And then as you slowly internalize, you start to repeat the words and then you start to compose the words. So in fact, all three levels were experienced by everybody in successive stages. And we said that we'll make a comment. We comment also at the end of the song. The end of the song, we'll keep this brief, but I want to conclude on this point. Reads as follows. It describes the song of Miriam. And we read, I'll just read it to you. Don't have to open the book. I'll read it to you. Don't worry. Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the cymbals, the drum, the tambourine in her hand, and all the women followed her with drums and dancing. Miriam led them in the response, sing to God for his great victory. Horse and rider he cast in the sea. And our sages point out, look at the difference. The man sang, it doesn't say they danced. And they certainly didn't bring any musical instruments. You've heard this quote before. Our sages ask, where do they get musical instruments? In the desert. There wasn't enough time for the bread to rise. In such haste they left. And yet they had musical instruments. And the Talmud answers, because the women had faith that God would perform miracles for them in anticipation and preparation for that, they took out musical instruments into the desert. We quoted this, remember? At our lecture on the status of women in Torah. Why was their faith so much stronger? And why was their joy that much greater? And why was it led by Miriam? And the answer is, Miriam was so called because she was born at a time when the slavery was at its most severe, its worst. And she was called Miriam. The word Miriam comes from the word Mar, which means bitter. She was so called because she felt the bitterness of exile more than the men. Miriam being representative and symbolic of all Jewish women. And that's why she is the one that when the Jewish child is cast into the water, her brother Moses, she is the one that stands and watches over him, which means that she is the one that plays the crucial role in the birth of the Redeemer. But on a simple level, it means that she is the one that is concerned and worried what's going to happen to this Jewish child. The point is that Torah is telling us that the Jewish woman has a deeper spiritual sensitivity than the male, and it's manifest in the two extremes. She feels the pain of exile more. That's Miriam. And then when redemption comes, she experiences the beauty of redemption and the joy of redemption more than the male. And it's only the one that can feel the pain of Golus that can really celebrate in the joy of Geula, of redemption. This is why the women, the Torah tells us, this was the Rebbe's last address, I've got to tell you. The Rebbe's last address on Shabbos B'Shalach was on this topic of the role of Jewish women in bringing about the redemption then and now. And in the two areas of feeling the pain and anguish of Jewish suffering of injustice in the world, and at the same time, they went out with the musical instruments because they knew that it was going to be good. They knew, despite the fact of being led into a desert and what's going to be tomorrow, redemption will follow, it's going to be good. And when it did, and the final redemption was not the Exodus itself, but when they crossed the Red Sea, therefore they burst into a celebration and dance that was far beyond the men. And so the Rebbe was saying, is now. He's saying women have to be at the vanguard of redemption. He actually went a step further in saying that since we have the absolute faith and confidence in God that redemption is near at hand, then the joy and celebration should begin already. And the women should be here too, at the forefront of the celebration and joy in in readiness and preparation for the redemption, the fact that it's still bitter, and the fact that we're still in exile, and yet we can still be joyous, because we know that this is the darkness will soon give way to light. And as it was then, so is it now that the women are the inspiration and take the leadership role, and the men follow in suit. May we merit the redemption very soon.